You know, every time the NFL gets ready to play a game in London, there's some news that comes out about the future of the NFL in London. And at some point, the games will be so prevalent in London, there won't be any news about London. That's not the case for now, though. It's the third game in London for the first time ever as the Jaguars host the Cowboys, and the NFL has announced the slate of games for next year in London. As expected, still three games. Jaguars going back again, as they've already agreed to do. They'll be hosting the Bills. Can we just dispense with that? Not that I'd be saying that to you. You'd be saying that to me. Anyway, the Lions will be returning, visiting the Chiefs, who surprisingly are giving up a home game. They have one of the great home field advantages in football. The Chiefs giving up that home game. And then finally, and perhaps most surprisingly, an AFC East battle, the Dolphins hosting the Jets. The NFL previously has shied away from division games in London because it creates a bit of a competitive disadvantage. The idea is, in the division where one of four teams is guaranteed a playoff spot and a home postseason game, you have those home and home round robins. And if you put the Jets in a position where they never have to go to Miami, they never really have that road game. They only have two true home field disadvantages, going to Buffalo and going to New England. You give the Jets a bit of an advantage. So beyond the Dolphins facing the Jets in New York and then not getting the Jets at their true home, you've got the Bills and the Patriots looking at this potentially and saying, well, wait a minute, the Jets have a little bit of an edge here because they don't have to go into truly hostile territory and play the Dolphins. Now, probably wasn't an issue because nobody expects the Jets to be any good next year, but on top of it, it shows that the NFL is willing to fiddle with this whole notion of competitive advantage and disadvantage to advance the broader agenda of making the sport as popular as it can be in London, which makes me think that despite all of the logistical hurdles, and you know what, if I have time, and I probably won't, but if I have time over the next few days, I need to do a post at profootballtalk.com listing all of the issues that need to be overcome. We talked about them with Mark Waller, the NFL VP of International, a couple of months ago. The potential problems that you get into, and you put a team in London and you have to give that team a different set of rules, and that can create a competitive disadvantage or the perception of one for the other 31 teams, especially if that team in London ends up being any good. My point is, and I think there is a point in here somewhere, that the idea of playing an intra-division game in London for the first time ever suggests that the NFL is willing to gloss over the things about which the NFL used to have a raging case of OCD, the notion of competitive disadvantage and competitive balance in the NFL. This is not competitive balance to have an intra-division game in London. NFL doesn't care. NFL willing to do it. And one other point that we made earlier today, if you didn't notice it on PFT, and if you didn't notice it, shame on you. You should be checking the site while you're listening to or watching this program. The Chiefs press release announcing their game against the Lions hints that it's going to be in that 9:30 a.m. Eastern time slot national broadcast because the Chiefs say that the game against the Lions will be broadcast locally and nationally by Fox. It won't be a national broadcast if it's a 1 p.m. Eastern time kickoff. The only way it's a national broadcast is if it's 9:30 in the morning, officially Eastern time. Officially, the NFL has not yet addressed the specific times these games will kick off, but you have to figure at least one of those games will kick off early in the East, very early in the West, middle of the afternoon in London. Middle of the afternoon Sunday in London, no, evening. You know, it was the first segment was going so well until I just completely screwed that up. Evening in London, it'll be Tony Romo or not against the Jacksonville Jaguars. Romo practiced today, and all signs are pointing to Romo playing with those two broken bones in his back. Not the main spinal column, but the transverse process, the spiny little bones that stick out from the spine. I'm still not sold that Romo's going to play. I still think there's a little bit of a Jedi mind trick going on here that the Cowboys hope the Jaguars spend time preparing for both guys, Romo and Brandon Whedon. And really, if it is going to be Romo, keep the Jaguars in the dark because they'll spend some time preparing for Whedon. Maybe they'll spend a lot of time preparing for Whedon. Either way, there's still a chance we could see Romo because he did practice today. But you know what? When quarterbacks practice in the NFL, what do they really do? They got the red jersey on. They can't be touched. They aren't hit. It's not really football practice like it is for everybody else. So, yeah, he practiced. How much did he do? And he wasn't in any danger. On Sunday, he'll be in danger, grave or otherwise. So I'm not ready to say Romo's going to play, and I think the Cowboys trying to milk this thing for all it's worth, because even though the Jaguars only have one win, they could rise up and win this game And then the Cowboys would find themselves at 6-4 with six games left. Now, before the season, Jerry Jones would have been thrilled to know that he'd be 6-4 going into the bye week. But 6-1 to 6-4 is a pretty steep fall. And if they lose to the Jaguars, it could be 8-8 time all over again for the Dallas Cowboys by the time it's all said and done. By the time Thursday is said and done, the Browns and the Bengals will have played each other in the most meaningful November game involving two Ohio teams in a while. Usually the meaningful November games involving an Ohio team usually involves a team from Michigan. Now it's Cleveland and Cincinnati in what should be a pretty good game tonight. We're hoping it's a good game. Not a ton of great Thursday night games so far this year. CBS probably wishes that it was still in its cycle of broadcasting these games nationally, because all of a sudden Browns-Bengals looking like a good game. We've seen this one coming. The Browns 5-3, the Bengals 5-2-1. And I want to see the Browns show that they can hang with a good team. It seems like not 4 weeks, but 4 years ago that the Browns beat the Steelers by 21 points. Since then, the Browns lost to Jacksonville in Jacksonville, not their home away from home. The Browns then only beat the Raiders by 10, only beat the Buccaneers by 5. I want to see the Browns show up, and I want to see Brian Hoyer play as well as he had been playing, because the clock could be ticking on Hoyer, and if this team hits a rough spot in the next few weeks, it could be Johnny Manziel time before the end of the season, and it definitely will be Johnny Manziel time come 2015 if Hoyer doesn't get back to where he was earlier this year. The Bengals with Jeremy Hill at running back instead of Giovanni Bernard. Hill looked good last week against the Jaguars. A.J. Green not even on the injury report. That's kind of a shock, because he has said that toe injury will bother him all year long. He won't be 100%. If you're not 100%, you should be on the injury report. He's not. It doesn't matter if he plays, but if he would leave the game early, or if for some reason he wouldn't play, I mean, that would be a major issue for the Bengals, because he's not even on the injury report. So look for Green to play. Look for Jeremy Hill to play. Look for the Bengals to try to continue to dig out of that hole that they fell into after the Patriots blew them out. When we come back, we will talk. You know, the teams at the bottom of the league don't get enough attention. Let's give some attention to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Rick Stroud, Tampa Bay Times, will be joining us to talk about where the Buccaneers are heading from here. They have a quarterback change, yet another. Quarterback of the past, quarterback of the future, quarterback of the present. Now he's quarterback of the past again. Is Mike Glennon falling out of favor? Will there be a new quarterback next year in Tampa? All sorts of questions for Rick Stroud when we return. And then, you know, good news, bad news. I get the gloat, good news for me, about the fact that I swept MDS for the second straight week and we are now tied in our picks contest. Bad news, there's nothing to disagree on this week. For the first time in the history, the long and, well, three-year history, however long we've been doing this, we agree on every game. So we've picked three to talk about. We'll talk about that to wrap the show. Before that, Rick Stroud. Before that, we'll take our first break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live.
It's a locker room full of guys that are really sick of losing and you know are wanting to find anything they can to help them get an edge to win a ball game, and so we're all on the same mindset. So with that being said, I'm ready to help this team.
That's Buccaneers' current starting quarterback, Josh McDown. He started the season as the starter. Mike Glennon was dubbed the quarterback of the future. He'd been the quarterback of the past. Then McCown got hurt. Glennon came in. McCown got healthy. Glennon kept the job. Now Glennon's lost the job to McCown. I just gave myself an aneurysm. what are we talking about? Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and here's our good buddy, Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times, to help us figure this out far more succinctly and understandably than I ever could explain it. Rick, why are we back to Josh McCown and not Mike Glennon?
Well, Mike, I think quite simply, you know, they looked at his last two games and you know, they struggled terribly against the Vikings for three quarters, had only about 95 yards of offense until the very end. And then last week, he simply missed open receivers all over the field, you know, and had a very extremely winnable game against the Cleveland Browns that they were unable to finish. And it's about finishing games for quarterbacks, as you know. Mike did some good things while he was in here. But Lovie Smith simply needs to win a game. I mean, they're 1-7 and only really 7 seconds away from being maybe 0-8. And when you're a new head coach, even as established one as Lovie is, you have to start showing some success. You need a buy-in from your players. And it starts by winning football games. And right now, McCown's thumb is back as healthy as it's going to be the rest of the year. And he just feels like, you know, this is something he can change, which is the quarterback, and hoping that Josh can give them a spark.
What does this mean, though, for Mike Glennon? Because we heard such great things from Lovie Smith about Glennon before Glennon was back in the lineup. Now he's being benched. Does this mean that maybe Mike Glennon isn't the team's quarterback of the future?
Yeah, it could mean that for sure. I mean, I think when you get to the end of the year, depending on their draft position, they're going to have to consider the quarterback spot, and they haven't had good play from either guy at this point. You know, a lot of the things we saw coming out of the draft, why Mike Glennon was a third-round pick, have shown up. You know, the more you play him, he's not just played a few games. You know, he's played 18 games. He's 5-13 over the last 2 years. You see the inaccuracies. You see the lack of mobility in the pocket, which can be a problem. You know, everything has to be perfect around him for him to really operate there. And, you know, so I think for all those things, the reason why he hasn't taken the reins and he had a great opportunity have shown up. And so, you know, whether he still has more maturing to do or developing to do, and there's a greater upside, I mean, he's still a young player. But right now, he doesn't look like a guy that's ready to take the reins and be that starter. And again, it always gets back to, you know, coaches speak about winning Sunday, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to win a game. And against Atlanta, they feel like, you know, Josh McCown will give them a better chance.
How much has the absence of offensive coordinator Jeff Tedford affected the team's inability to win games?
Mike, I think that's been the biggest story of their season. I can't emphasize it enough. I mean, it's devastating. I saw a similar situation happen to Raheem Morris's first year when Jeff Jagodzinski was fired or let go 10 days before the season, but they had Greg Olsen to turn to at called plays in the NFL, even though they couldn't change the offense. But this is a situation where Lovie Smith had four coordinators in Chicago. This has always been sort of, you know, his problem, trying to match up the quarterback and the coordinators. He chooses Jeff Tedford, and then a terrible thing happens. He has to have a heart procedure. And more than that, he's not able to come back from it. I mean, typically the kind of procedure he has, you know, they really thought he would come back, but Jeff didn't feel right. So now he's gone, and you turn it over to a 34-year-old, you know, guy in Marcus Arroyo, who had never called a play except at Southern Mississippi. This is a huge story. He's gotten better as they've gone along. But there's no way to quantify what a play caller means. Just look what happened to the New Orleans Saints when Sean Payton was missing for a year. They had all the same personnel. It just didn't work.
Rick, who do you think the offensive coordinator for the Buccaneers will be in 2015?
I have no idea. It's a great question. I mean, I don't think it's going to be Marcus Arroyo, and I don't think it's going to be anybody on this staff. You know, if you looked out on the landscape of the NFL right now, there's a guy that coached the Cleveland Browns last year, and Jeff Chizinski, who's just a terrific play caller. I don't know if that's somebody that would be on their list. They have to go back into the whole process again. So this will be two coordinators in 2 years, which does set your program back if you're Lovie Smith. And, you know, again, for a guy that's a defensive coach that really needs help on that side of the ball, it's going to be an enormous hire for them in the offseason.
Is the quarterback week one 2015 currently on the roster?
You know, I think he is. I think it's going to be one of the two guys. And I say that because I don't see how you can go into the draft without choosing a young player. And it looks like they'll be drafting high enough. You know, I don't know if they're going to win 1, 3, 5, you know, games. I really don't. But and that'll affect it. It just seems to me that either Glennon, who still has 2 years left on his contract, or McCown, who's a little more expensive commodity at $5 million a year, is probably going to be a bridge guy to a younger quarterback. I mean, I think one of those two guys could start the season, you know, and then you bring along a rookie after that. Other than that, you're going to have to go the free agent route and look at a player like a Sam Bradford or somebody who's coming off injury that, you know, had an upside at one time and hope you can capture a lightning in a bottle.
Looks like Doug Martin, first-round pick 2012, falling out of favor at running back, with Bobby Rainey playing well, Charles Sims getting an opportunity to get back into it. Do you expect Martin to be back next year?
You know, I don't. It's possible because of his contract situation. He's still an affordable player, and we'll see what happens the rest of the year. I think Charles Sims is ultimately going to be their main guy, a guy that reminds Lovie Smith and others of Matt Forte and his skill set. Bobby Rainey is averaging 4.6 yards per carry. He is their best running back on the football team. And for whatever reason, Doug has not been able to recapture what he did as a rookie. There has been opportunities to run better than he has run. He's been nicked up all season, certainly missed last year with a shoulder. So, you know, if there's a market for him and in the offseason, I think he's somebody they would look at moving for draft picks.
There was talk about Vincent Jackson possibly being traded. Jay Glazer of Fox reported over the weekend that the Eagles made a run at Jackson. Did the Buccaneers ever have any inclination to move him if they could?
They did, Mike. I think the problem was is that, you know, because of his age, teams weren't inclined to give them any real value. And if you look at this team, you know, they like the development of Mike Evans. And they wanted to see, and they still want to see what they have in Mike Glennon and win football games. And, you know, Vincent Jackson facilitates that. I think, you know, to give him up for a fifth or sixth round pick would really cripple their offense to a point where you couldn't even evaluate those other players. So he was important in a lot of aspects. Now, next year, coming back with a $10 million salary, if Mike Evans continues to ascend the way he did in this past game and can prove he's capable of being a number one receiver, then you might have a situation next year where, you know, maybe Vincent Jackson isn't with him either.
Yeah, and that's one of the few bright spots for the Buccaneers this year. Mike Evans looks like the real deal. Mike Evans looks every bit as good as Sammy Watkins, possibly with more of an upside because of his size. What is the ceiling for a guy like Mike Evans, in your view?
Well, I think it's very high. I mean, you know, the thing about Mike was he got caught among a lot of high draft picks in sort of the post-combine rubber chicken tour. And put on some pounds after that. You know, a lot of whining and dining by other teams. Got in the training camp, pulled a hamstring, really OTAs, didn't do much in the off season, was behind, and he's just now sort of rounding into shape. He's had some injuries as well. He's got to take care of his body and learn, like most young players do, that you know, you have to get in at night and you have to you know, save yourself for Sunday, so to speak. But I think he's got tremendous hands, a huge upside, and can be a real impact receiver for a lot of years if he wants to be. It's going to come down to just whether he realizes what his potential is and he grabs it early in his career.
One of the surprise moves made by the Buccaneers not long before the start of the season, the trade for Logan Mankins, brought him down from New England. The sense so far has been that Mankins has been a disappointment. Some think he won't be back next year. What's your assessment?
Well, that's a big number. You know, it's the same reason that New England looked at getting rid of him. I think you're looking at $7 or $8 million for a player who's clearly past his prime. I think the draft is going to have to be one of their focus has to be the offensive line. It's the weakest area of their team. Logan has a lot of intangibles, but, you know, at this point he's never been a great pass protector. I'm not sure what he can give them, and they're still probably several years from being what you would call a real contending team. But if it merely comes down to salary, that's going to be a tough one. You know, I guess it'll depend on how well he plays the next eight games.
Defensively, I get the impression that Lovie Smith wants to run his system the way he wants to run it, and instead of adapting the system to the players he has, he's just going to get rid of the players that don't fit and find players that do. Is that an accurate assessment of what's going on?
No, I think you're exactly right, Mike. I mean, he's been doing this for a long time, and you know, a lot is made about the Tampa 2 system and this sort of thing. Look, they won a Super Bowl, you know, running essentially the same thing last year in Seattle. Carolina's been a top defense, so you know, it's not scheme, but you have to have the pieces. And he's got the biggest pieces he already has. He's got the three technique in Gerald McCoy. He's got the wheel linebacker in Levante David. Now, you know, on the back end, I mean, we're talking about players that may not be here. You know, you have safety back there that may not be here either, making $9 million. Mark Barron's already gone. But you have to have guys that can play both in space and cover, track the ball, and also be able to go down and be physical in the box. And Mark Barron was able to do one of those things. He could root out some running backs, but he missed tackles. There was no splash plays over the last year or so. And I think they saw an opportunity. They realized the best evaluator of your team is when you get in the regular season. And they realized, we got a lot of holes here. And how are we going to fill them? Free agency hasn't worked out for them this year. So you got to start acquiring draft picks. An opportunity came with Mark Barron to get a couple of picks for him from the Rams, and they decided to pull the trigger.
Rick, I've got a feeling that when March rolls around and free agency opens, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to be spending big, as we've seen them do in the past. They don't give out a lot of signing bonuses. They do guaranteed salaries. They've got plenty of cap space. They always do. Do you get the feeling that Lovie Smith is going to retool this roster by going after guys who are going to come available in free agency?
Well, I mean, it has to some degree, and you're right. They do have they always have the money to spend. They got to look down the road a little bit at, having to give Levante David a pretty big contract in a year or so. That's going to be something. So maybe it won't be quite as much as it was this year, but there's only two ways to get better, and that's free agency and the draft. And the draft picks take a while to develop. So I think the goal will be to win as soon as you can. And, yeah, I do. I think that there'll be players again and probably jump out on two or three guys, much as they have the last few years.
Now, at 1-7, with the Falcons coming to town, the Falcons haven't won since beating the Buccaneers 56-14. How much do you think that blowout loss on a Thursday night resonates with the Buccaneers as they get ready to welcome the Falcons?
I think it matters to them, Mike, because, that sort of was a turning point. I think every season has one. And, up to then, they had lost two close games with Josh McCown at quarterback, really just starting their program. They didn't feel bad about themselves until they came out of that game, and it was 56-14, and it shook them. And then we got to see that it wasn't just an aberration. Baltimore Ravens did a very similar thing to them a few weeks later. And so I think, for both teams, it's amazing to me Atlanta has not won a game since. And so now you have this rematch, and, what is each team going to do the second half of the season? There's a lot of elements, a lot of guys – have redemption on their minds. I mean, Josh McCown, his first game back since getting knocked out by Atlanta. Bobby Rainey had two fumbles in that game. Now he's sort of the starting running back. The Bucs are certainly better than they were in week three, but Atlanta's desperate. I mean, there's a coach in the NFC South named Smith that might get fired, and it's not the guy that lost 56-14.
What do you think? I look at every week who's on the hot seat, who's not. I don't get the impression that anybody in Tampa is in any trouble, that this really is a scholarship year, even though they had hoped it would be much better than a scholarship year. Do you get the impression there'll be any changes after this season?
No, sort of getting an offensive coordinator and maybe some staff guys when they evaluate everything. No, I don't. I think, that's what's crippled this franchise. When you have three coaches in 4 years and you can see what happened to the draft, certain guys don't fit. I mean, Mark Barron was a 7th overall pick, and that's generally what happens. Everybody comes in, they have their own scheme. The players they have, if they can't adapt them to it, then they move them. And so, you're constantly really not building anything. And so continuity is what this franchise needs. I think Lovie's capable of that. By the same token, you don't want to go 1-15 because that makes next season a lot more important than maybe it should be even. But I think that, there won't be any changes here. At least until beyond 2015.
Well, great stuff, Rick. Appreciate some of your time. We'll be talking down the road. We'll keep an eye on what the Bucs can do over the balance of the season. Thanks again.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me. I appreciate any time.
There he is, Rick Stroud, Tampa Bay Times. Good insight on the Bucs. And, you don't want to finish 1-15, but it'd be kind of nice to have that number one overall draft pick. Once you know it's over, and I say this all the time, the NFL needs to have some sort of a draft lottery, because why wouldn't you try to get yourself in position to get the highest possible pick in the draft? And I know players and coaches will never tank. They have too much pride. They're not wired that way. A lot of the players may not be there, especially if the team's really bad. But there are ways that an owner can influence how a team fares down the stretch by saying, I'd like to see what the fourth-string quarterback can do. Let's put him in for the last three games of the season. I'd like to see what the third-string cover corner can do. Let's bench these guys with the big salaries who are starters, and let's go with the young guys. Let's see what the young guys can do. There are very easy ways to do it if teams want to, and there is a real temptation to do it. And it's amazing to me, as competitive as the NFL is year to year and as much value is put in those draft picks, why we have yet to see a team sort of try to get that highest possible draft pick. Once the season's over, once it's done, if you're not on the hot seat, lose games and get yourself in the best position possible. And again, the coach and the GM may not have a role in it. Maybe the GM could say to the coach, we want to see what the four-string quarterback can do, but has been no evidence of it yet, and maybe there never will be, although, boy, having that number one overall pick instead of number five can be a big difference for a team trying to turn it around. I've managed to turn it around in the PFT Picks contest. I was 5 games back 2 weeks ago, and now it is level as they would say in the other football. I've been using that a lot lately because I've been playing a lot of FIFA. When we come back, a guy that I would beat soundly in FIFA if we were ever to play, MDS and I, will talk about three games on which we agree for this week because we don't disagree on any. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. And it's time for this week's PFT Picks, powered by Subway, where winners eat. And I've been eating good. Down 5 games 2 weeks ago. Not anymore. Not behind. Tied up. Tied with MDS. 11-2 last week. How about that? We're both 86-48 for the year. 64.1%. And I guarantee you, I tried to get MDS to make a really big bet with me, because I sent him an email saying, I will bet you everything I own that you will not be in the lead after this weekend. He saw through it. He understood that that meant that I had plugged in my picks with his picks. He puts his in first. I put mine in second. He trusts me not to change any of mine, idiot. And he wouldn't bet me because we don't disagree on anything this week. We're still going to talk about some games, some of the closer games, some of the ones that at least gave me some heartburn, but he's the one who had the heartburn on Sunday as the, what was it? The Cardinals beat the Cowboys, the Steelers beat the Ravens, and the Patriots beat the Broncos, which allowed me to close that gap from 3-0. MDS, what do you have to say for yourself? And hang your head in shame while you answer the question.
You did, in fact, go 3-for-3 in the games on which we disagreed. However, one of those games, I specifically said I was picking the Cowboys because I thought Tony Romo would be able to play. I think it should have been kind of like a half win for you since it was Brandon Whedon who played for the Cowboys. And I also got a perfect score, which you have not done this season. That ought to be a bonus point. So I feel like I'm kind of sort of still in the lead.
No, there's no tiebreaker. There are no separate rules. We're not like the league office where we make things up as we go. The rules are gross wins, period. That's it. And I did give you credit on Twitter. I gave you credit on the website. Amazing. And this wasn't like 23-20 or 24-21. 22-17, as you discovered, only 15 times before in the history of the NFL had a final score been 22-17. You guessed 22-17, Browns-Bucks, and that was the final score. That was impressive, but that's just style points. That has nothing to do with this contest. And the whole, I thought it was going to be Tony Romo, you need to read the website that you work for and that you run as managing editor a little bit more carefully, because I was trying to send out the messages to folks, don't expect to see Tony Romo. I didn't think we were going to see Tony Romo. I wasn't able to report it. There's a lot of stuff I can't report that I know, and I knew I had a little inside information there, MDS. Romo wasn't going to play, and you should have trusted what you were seeing on the pages of PFT.
I don't like your use of the word guess to describe me getting that score exactly right. I spent a great deal of time carefully thinking through both of those teams, and 22-17 was exactly the score that I expected. It wasn't a guess.
Oh, come on. Well, you should have spent some of that time on the three games that you got wrong. Oh, all right. Well, I hope you get none wrong this week. I hope you're right on every game that we have projected for this week, because we agree on everything. But there are a few games that I do have that sense of maybe I'm going to be wrong about. 49ers at Saints. The Saints are hard to beat at home. The 49ers are getting desperate. We both like the Saints. Tell me why you went that way.
I like the Saints because the 49ers are getting desperate. I just don't think this San Francisco team is really all that good. I think that there are real problems with this 49ers team. They may get better late in the season. Alden Smith returns. Navarro Bowman returns. Having those two guys back, I mean, that is two very good defensive players. Certainly, I would expect their defense to get better. But I just see a lot of problems on this team, on the 49ers. Their offense couldn't get anything going against the Rams. The Rams' pass rush was just killing Colin Kaepernick. I'm not real high on this 49ers offense, and even against a mediocre at best defense like the Saints, I just think that the Saints are going to win this game and win it kind of comfortably. I went 28-17. I don't see this as a real close game. I like the Saints.
Yeah, I think the 49ers can keep it fairly close, but they are desperate, and I don't know what's wrong with this team. Maybe there is friction in the locker room. Maybe the players have just gotten sick of all the dysfunction that has been filtering through the organization the past couple of years, and maybe it is time for Jim Harbaugh to move on, although any team out there looking for a new coach should run at the opportunity to bring Harbaugh to town, because competitive team plus dysfunction is better than non-competitive team plus dysfunction that comes from being non-competitive. But I think the Saints are finding the gas pedal to go on the road and beat the Panthers fairly comfortably. It was an impressive development. They're getting better on the fly. They're in control of that division. I don't see them letting up. I don't see them losing at home for the rest of the year, although I don't want to tip my picks in all future Saints home games. I reserve the right to change my mind on that. But I do like the idea of the Saints beating the 49ers on Sunday, and the 49ers plunging under 500, the latest in the season that they've ever been under 500 under Jim Harbaugh. A lot of pressure, a lot of stress, two games with the Seahawks looming, another game against the Cardinals, and they're falling farther and farther behind the surprisingly first-place Cardinals in the NFC West. Speaking of the Cardinals, they will host the St. Louis Rams. The Rams have beaten the 49ers and the Seahawks this year. I think the Rams could pull this one off, but when it came down to it, I wasn't able to pick the Rams because the Cardinals have proven that they're not susceptible to stepping into a pothole. Why did you go with Arizona?
Well, I picked a closer score than you did, so I also was not totally sold that this is quite the sure thing that it would look like when you're talking about a Rams team that has played kind of mediocre at best this season, going on the road to play a Cardinals team that has the best record in the NFL right now. I think this could be a pretty close game. I like that Rams defensive front to put a lot of pressure on Carson Palmer. I think in the end, I wasn't ready to pick against them because the Cardinals have been a tough team to pick against. But a point is coming when the Cardinals are going to fall back to earth. I don't know if it'll be this week against the Rams, next week against the Lions, the week after that against the Seahawks. But this Cardinals team, they're a good team, but I don't think they're as good as 7-1 suggests. And I think over the second half of the season, they might go something more like 4-4. Now, hey, 4-4 over the second half equals 11-5. That's almost certainly going to get them into the playoffs. I'm not saying the Cardinals aren't right in there in the NFC, but I don't think they're as good as 7-1, and I do think they're going to lose at some point. That's why I picked a very close game with the Rams, but in the end, I think the Cardinals will pull this one out.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone in your belief that the Cardinals are going to have a correction at some point. I think they've already had the correction, and they've weathered the storm, the weeks with Drew Stanton, the players they've lost. I don't know that there's going to be a correction. Now, I'm not ready to say they're going to be 14-2. But Bruce Arians knows how to press the buttons of these guys. That whole idea of hosting the Super Bowl and not being afraid of it, embracing the idea of not wanting anyone else to dress in your lockers. I mean, you keep saying that. You keep getting these guys feeling confident about themselves, having a chip on their shoulders because people like you, MDS, don't believe in them. I believe in the Cardinals now. It's hard to get past those uniforms, that logo. That really doesn't inspire a whole lot of intimidation. But the Cardinals, I think, are turning into one of the best teams in the entire league. Right now, the best team in the NFC, and I think they keep it rolling on Sunday, even though the Rams are going to give them everything that they can handle. On Sunday night, the Bears may give the Packers everything they can handle, but I don't think it's going to matter. The Green Bay Packers, the only thing that's going to keep the Packers from winning is if Aaron Rodgers re-injures that hamstring and they have to bring in Matt Flynn. I selected this one just because there really weren't any other games I felt uncomfortable about, and it's on NBC, so we may as well talk about the NBC game. Why do you think the Packers are going to win?
Well, I think the Packers are just a fundamentally better team, really, on both sides of the ball than the Bears are. The interesting thing to me, though, and I live in Chicago, and the sense you get around here is that people think the Bears are just done. People think that Trestman has done a really bad job with this team this year, and that Jay Cutler has done a really bad job this year. People are very down on the Bears, and yet, if they could pull this upset at Green Bay, they'd be right back in the thick of things, because if you look at the Bears' schedule going forward, there are still a lot of winnable games on the Bears' schedule. It's not like they are totally done. If they could beat the Packers, they would then only be a game behind the Packers. They still get the Lions twice. Their next two games after this trip to Green Bay are home against the Vikings and home against the Buccaneers. Certainly two games they should win. It's not like they are far off from turning their season around, but it is just that I simply don't think they're nearly as good a team as the Packers. The offense is certainly not playing as well as the Packers' offense is. And the Bears' defense, I think it's a little bit better than it was last year, but, you know, Lamar Houston, one of the expensive defensive ends they invested in, is already out for the season. Jared Allen, the other one, is not playing as well as he has for his long career, and you start to wonder, as Jared Allen lost a step now that he's in his 30s. I think when you look at this Bears roster, you just don't see as good a team as I think most of us thought we were going to see before this season.
Yeah, 4 out of 5 losses, no wins at home, and a lack of leadership in the locker room, and the head coach not a guy who comes off as someone who can command a locker room and provide leadership that isn't coming naturally and organically from the players in it. I think the bottom for the Bears is still to come, and this is going to be the test. If they can pull this one off or at least make it close, then you go into those last 7 games thinking, you know what, maybe we have a chance here. But losing to Green Bay Sunday night, as I believe they will, drops them to 3-6, and they basically have to run the table. And you mentioned Vikings and Buccaneers coming to Soldier Field. The Bears still haven't won a game at Soldier Field this year. Something's wrong with this team fundamentally. The question is, who's going to be gone after the season's over? Because I don't see them turning it around, and I think that process continues on Sunday night with the Packers winning possibly easily as long as that hamstring stays healthy enough for Aaron Rodgers to do his thing. MDS, thanks as always. Let's do this again next week.
Sounds good. I hope we have something to disagree about next week, and I hope I'm right about that disagreement.
I hope you continue to be wrong. And there they were, your PFT picks for Week 10, powered by Subway, where winners eat. Powered by Subway, where winners eat. And I'm going to go eat some Subway now because, hey, he was getting very, very cocky when he was up 5 games 2 weeks ago because it's hard to make up 5 games. I made him up in 2 weeks. So we'll see what happens next week. Hopefully we'll go 13-0 this week. This is the last week of the 6 teams on a bye. 4 teams next week, and then I think the byes are over, which means more opportunities to disagree and more opportunities for me to pull away from MDS. That's it for today's edition of PFT Live. 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time tonight, NBCSN's Pro Football Talk. Chris Collinsworth via Skype. John Ritchie, Brian Westbrook in studio. We'll get you ready for Browns-Bengals, a sneaky good Thursday night game. Continue to get you ready for Week 10 of NFL action. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Tentatively scheduled to have Vikings defensive end Everson Griffin on the program. Looking forward to talking to him. He's like one of the main leaders in NFL sacks. He got the big contract. He has responded well. We look forward to a chance to talk to him tomorrow. We look forward to a chance to talk to you possibly. PFT Planet, maybe. We may have a second guest. Maybe PFT Planet. We'll see what happens. Check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a good day. See you tomorrow.